Welcome to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn, here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Each week, we interview women who are kicking buns, both big and small, throughout the borough. Every episode features an in-depth talk with a female mover and shaker who's deeply invested in the community. Find out how she's doing her part to make Brooklyn a better place to live for old-timers and newcomers alike. I'm your host, Christine Stoddard.
And I'm Mari Pack.
We're excited to have with us Krista Sammons from the NWL, National Women's Liberation. Welcome, Krista.
Thank you.
So Krista lives in Greenpoint with her boyfriend and 7-year-old son. She's a commercial interior designer with a firm in New York City, and she's been a designer for about 14 years. She grew up in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, but moved around a bit since graduating at the University of Florida. She moved to New York 5 years ago from Singapore after splitting up with her ex-husband slash baby daddy. She is a certified doula, which she focused on for a couple of years after her son was born, after taking a little break from design. She has long considered herself a feminist, but only recently became active with the new threats to women's liberation. She has personal experience with both abortion and birth control, and is passionate about keeping both of these accessible to women. She joined NWL the day after the election and then became a part of the Reproductive Rights Committee. So, Krista, what drove you exactly to NWL? Was it just Trump in particular? Was it, what was happening in the world that you saw and you're like, oh, I gotta get active about this?
I think it was such a wake-up call, sort of a slap in the face.
Yep.
Oh, sexism is real. I'm not making this up. Because we just had an overly qualified woman run against an immensely underqualified man.
Yes.
And she lost. And so, you know, given the Russia thing, whatever, you still can't deny the overt sexism that was involved. So for me, it was just, there's almost comfort in it. Oh, I'm not alone. I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
And everyone that I've been trying to explain this to, who's looked at me like I'm a monster, now it's kind of, I feel free to express that.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to the NWL meeting like the week after Trump was elected?
I did. Well, yes. That was the first meeting that I ever went to, actually.
Mm-hmm. Me too, actually. So we were both there.
Yeah, it was the biggest turnout, I think, that they have had.
Yeah, in a long
unsurprisingly.
Time. Unsurprisingly. Yeah. I think many people felt the way you felt and I felt, which is like, I don't even know what to, like, all the things I've been saying for years and years and years, I've been yelling at people about.
Yeah.
And they've been telling me that I'm just like a brat for not being complacent or basically not saying like, oh, I, like many of the things in my life are easy and this isn't Saudi Arabia, so I should be grateful.
Exactly.
There's Why so aren't you a nice fun. Lady? You're just so mean. You're so rude and ungrateful.
Just be happy with what you have. You know,
yeah.
You're in a high position at your office. You know, what do you have? You're making a great salary. So you should just be happy with that.
Why do you want to be CEO? You're going to get married and have babies, and then you're going to have to leave.
So for people that aren't familiar with NWL, what is that?
National Women's Liberation. So it was a group that really is focusing on everything from equal pay to reproductive rights. And it's really about making sure that women are represented and overthrowing the patriarchy. And there is, I would like to note also that there is a Women of Color Caucus that is part of the NWL that meet separately.
Okay. And now how are they connected? Why was it deemed crucial by the NWL to have this Women of Color Caucus?
It had to do a lot with a lot of the issues that they deal with that white women don't, and how racism intersects with sexism on a different level. So they get to meet independently and express their experiences in a free and open environment and then bring that information back to the overall organization so that we can have a better understanding of what they're dealing with.
So for so the primary mode of NWL, as I know it, is to hold these consciousness raisings.
Yes.
Where women come and they express basically their stories in a way that allows them and other feminists to sort of deconstruct what is happening in the larger societal space and, like, what is happening under patriarchy. And when I first went to it, what it felt like to me was, like, in the same way that when Trump was elected, you're like, oh, I'm not crazy. Like, that's kind of how it felt to me, too, when I went. I don't know if that's also how you felt, like, during your first experience with them.
Absolutely. I hosted one in Greenpoint about 2 weekends ago. And it's very reassuring hearing. It's sad because it's all bad stuff.
Right.
We're all experience. We're all commiserating. But it's also, there's a reassurance of, like you said, we're not crazy. We're all in this together. We're all experiencing it. Okay, so now that we've talked about it, let's figure out how to fight it. And we did have a couple of women who, even discussing birth control, were like, oh my gosh, until talking about this, I never realized how much it was my responsibility. You know, because you just assume, this is what I do, I take care of this, it's my body, whatever, like, I have to be responsible for not getting pregnant, pay for it, I have to do all of this.
And like, I have to deal with all of the awful side effects.
Absolutely.
I had an experience recently where, like, I started going on birth control after being off it for a long time because it was like, oh, I'm getting all these awful side effects, I'm going to go off birth control. But then I wanted to go on birth control again. I did that thing that we sometimes do where I'm like, maybe I was crazy. Like, maybe I was the crazy one.
There's a lot of crazy going around.
Yeah, like, right, like, it was just my fault. And I went on it again and was just, like, had all these, like, awful mood swings. And I actually, like, told my partner at the time, like, I'm really sorry. Like, this is my fault that I can't handle, like, being on so much estrogen that I just want to scream at everything all the time. He was like, it's not. Like, I hadn't had a male partner in a really long time for whom they hadn't been like, okay, so you go on birth control and that's your responsibility, but it's also your responsibility to make that invisible to me.
Yes.
To make whatever struggle that is one that I don't have to deal with. So, like, if you're going to be pumped full of estrogen, like a pregnant woman all the time, like, also don't be crabby and, like, still be sweet and nice and wonderful.
Absolutely.
To me. And you just have these moments as a woman all the time where you're like, oh, I this like perspective, and like now I'm sad because I realize how much I'm oppressed.
Yeah. And you're expected to do it all and also be invisible at the same time. Kind of work.
Yeah, yeah, not complain. And,
yeah.
Not be mean, not be crabby.
And
well,
yeah.
You have every right to be.
Absolutely. And the payment factor, you know, we discussed a lot about, it's assumed that the woman is going to pay for birth control, right?
Right.
It's my medication. It's almost looked at as if I was diabetic. I'm not going to ask my partner to pay for half of my diabetes medication.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lack of awareness in that respect of it's always on the woman, you know, to take care of the cost of that.
So I noticed in reading the literature that you sent me about the committee that one of the things you want to change is this idea that, like, doctors should also ask men what kind of birth control they use.
Yes.
And that was another one of those things where, like, once again, it never, like, it occurred to me in the back of my mind, but, like, it, I'd never thought that, like, oh yeah, we can make that a priority. And, like, how was that something that you brought to the table? Is that something that was already there? Like, how does that idea come about?
That came about in one of the discussions, and we were talking about the difficulty that, you know, that people, women have had in the group with access to birth control.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's anywhere from going on vacation and forgetting your pills or
right.
having to make your 6-month appointment because you run out of your prescription and
yeah.
you don't have time to go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way that, you know, getting doctors more involved on the male side? Is there a way that men can get birth control prescriptions for you through
oh.
their doctor?
I didn't
yeah.
ever
so that
think
you
about that.
Have, right? So, one, you don't have to pay for it. The prescription's in their name.
Right.
And two, if you're out of town or something, or your schedule doesn't allow you to get it, is there a way to make it just more accessible from all sides, and it engages them more? It makes them more responsible in the whole process.
That's a good point.
Yeah, somehow I see being married, like marriage being a requirement for that, just because marriage is a requirement for so many things that involve the man and the woman.
Like being in a reproductive relationship.
Yeah, yeah, just like, oh, well, we wouldn't be able to, even if the man were able to get the pills, it would be, oh, well, we can only give them to you if you're legally married to her. We can't
and
give them to...
And then they would, like, cite it for insurance reasons.
Right? Yeah, and then there would be all this paperwork involved.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, there are two people having sex, and they both have to be equally responsible. Can't just be one person all the time.
Right. And I think there is a lot of these consciousness-raising discussions about birth control. It, you know, there were so many times where women had experiences with having sex with a male partner, and they either lied about using a condom or put up a fight about it.
Yeah. All this, like,
and this happens all the time.
Yeah.
It does. Like, I read a tweet once, so like, if you were a man and you have, like, cajoled a woman for using a condom, like, you're a crap, you're a shit human being. Like, full stop. And, like, she's like, I know that that's a disturbingly high number of you, but it's true. If you, like, control a woman, you're like, I don't want to wear a condom. Like, yeah. You're a shit stain of a human being.
Yeah.
And I know that is a large percentage of men, and the older I get, the less of a problem I have just, like, damning that many men. Be like, no, like, you have to, like, rise up to this.
Yes, absolutely. I had a guy once tell me, basically accuse me of having an STD because I wanted him to wear a condom. Oh, why are you so insistent? What's wrong with you? Like, that's the point. I don't want there to be something wrong with me. Yeah, it's pretty disgusting.
All right, so I want to go a little bit far back, because we are talking about what you're doing now, and it's all this awesome work with the NWL. But one of the things I noticed about your bio is that you've considered yourself a feminist for a long time. So how did that come about for you? Like, what age were you when you realized, oh, this is a problem? Were you, like, in college? Did it come in your mid-20s? Like, what? How did it work for you?
I think it starts really from, you know, that early kind of sexual development. And I don't think it's a conscious thing that, oh, I'm a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are things that happen throughout your life where you become more aware of kind of injustices, and you don't have that realization until you're a little older. You have more of a voice.
Right.
And, you know, honestly, when I was younger, there still is such a negative connotation with the word feminist.
Man-hater.
Yeah.
Feminazi. Yeah.
And so I was so timid to even say that word, but I knew that I valued equal treatment. I knew that I saw that there were so many inequalities that were happening just in daily life and in you know, discussions and just the way we interact together. But then it's definitely evolved since then, and I think after having, you know, being through relationships and having a kid, definitely.
I was like, yeah, you have a son.
Yeah. And I don't want to say that it completely changes you. You're still the same person. It just you keep evolving, and now you have someone to be responsible for, and that is looking to you to kind of set that example. So it's more of a, okay, now I have to prove everything that I'm saying. Now I kind of have to prove it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Act instead of being all talk.
So how are you raising him to be a good little man who respects women?
Poor kid. He's been through a lot. We had a sex talk when he was 5.
Whoa! That is.
But so how do you explain sex to a 5-year-old?
Good question. It came about pretty organically. The first time we talked about female anatomy, he was actually younger. He was about 3.5, 4, and I was. We lived in a railroad apartment, just the two of us. We were very close. And I had the door open. I was about to take a shower, and I had pulled down, you know, my underwear, and I had just gotten my period. And he looked at me and he said, "You pooped your pants."
You better get educated.
Yeah, like, sit down. You are not going to pre-K tomorrow telling your class that your mom pooped her pants. We're out of, you know, salvaging my reputation.
Among the 3.5-year-olds.
Yeah, you can tell your classmates your mother is menstruating.
Exactly. So we went a little bit through just, like, you know, a period. And then at 5, it always happens in the bathroom somehow. We were talking about babies. And I explained to him about, you know, sex. And I said, you know, you were born because your dad and I had sex. You know, you have a penis, I have a vagina. That goes in there, and then there's sperm that's released, and that fertilizes the egg, and then probably took it too far and went into labor and delivery, which you maybe didn't need to know how to
give him the whole story, as one must.
Yeah, you're like, be grateful. I went through that for you.
You owe me. But no, we've always had a very open relationship, and since this has happened, I've taken him to some marches with me.
Really?
I've been having the consciousness raising that I hosted, he was there for, so he got to hear, you know, some of the discussion, which was great, kind of passively, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just we're very vocal and have a very open dialogue at home. He wanted to watch all of the debates, so
really?
Which meant I had to watch them twice.
That's adorable and amazing.
What did he say about them? Like, how does a 7-year-old engage with a debate?
He is very anti-Trump. The great thing about it is it brought up so many topics that we hadn't discussed yet, like abortion. For one, that was huge.
And you talked to your son about abortion?
We did.
I feel like I'm learning so much.
Could you talk to us, we're your son? How did the story go? What words do you use?
It was during the debate when he mentioned abortion and going in and ripping out babies, right?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, I need to explain to you that, first of all, that's not how abortion works, you know? And I was like, it happens when a woman can't have a baby, either physically or financially. She doesn't have the money to do it. Or she just doesn't have the support, or maybe just isn't in the right place, or doesn't, you know, feel like having a baby at that time. And then the doctor goes in and has ways of, you know, removing the cells, or, you know, she can take a pill that can help kind of, rupture the cells, or I forget what word I used, but he was like, oh, okay. And what's great about children is they'll retain what they're able to process. Really? So we've had these conversations. Yeah. But we kind of have to keep having them.
But acquire more information from the outside. So since you've had that conversation, I don't know where else a 7-year-old is going to be talking about abortion, but has he come to you with new information and been like, wait, so you told me this and now I have this new information. What am I supposed to do with that?
I don't know that he's really, no, not about that. And I don't know if maybe they just don't really talk about it. As far as, this was interesting though, this has more to do with kind of slut shaming and how early on this starts and the whole, how you develop your, you know, feminist theories from that. He had a friend who told me the story that his friend was on the bus with this girl, and I won't use names because...
His male friend
was on the bus with a female classmate. They're 7, second grade. And that his friend said that the female friend took off all her clothes on the bus. And I almost lost my shit. I said, sit down. That is absolutely not true. There's no way that girl took her clothes off on the bus. And I said, second of all, this is so important. You cannot spread that rumor. You need to confront him and tell him that he cannot go around saying this. And I explained to him how much this could hurt this girl, and it could, you know, ruin her reputation, and it could get her into trouble and all this stuff. But it was so devastating that, oh my God, you're 7, and you're already starting, it's already starting.
Is there a fear for you as the mother of a son that, I guess, your son will be the type of man that women fear? I don't have a son, so I don't know how this works. But I imagine that would be a fear that I would have also, that I would want to produce a son that would treat women as people and be a feminist ally. But there's only so much control you have over your children. They are not you. I don't know if that's a fear that you grapple with.
My biggest fear is white straight men. Quite honestly. Yeah. I mean, that's my biggest fear. I think about that all the time, and it's not just be respectful, it's how do you handle yourself in sexual situations, you know?
Yeah.
When, yeah, no means no, but there are so many nuances that go into that, and really being, I don't know, being aware and being a champion for women and making sure that, and also sticking up for them. Like when your male friends are saying bad things, stick up for them. And yeah, it's terrifying.
Does your son have female friends that he plays with outside of school?
He does. He does. He has a couple of good friends that are female. But he definitely, I've noticed that, you know, he came to me and said, I don't like my new table because I'm the only boy at it.
Oh.
I was like, no, what's the issue? Like, why do you not, you know, do you feel like you don't have things in common? And so we had a discussion about that, trying to find things in common that you had with these girls. And so that kind of helped a little bit. But it's amazing how quickly they get this, like, gender, you know, distinction, like us and them. And it's sad.
Yeah, I remember in kindergarten, my little girlfriends and I had a male friend, and he only ever played with us. He didn't play with the boys. He didn't like the boys. And the mothers, even back then, I remember the mothers would say things like, oh, he's gay. He's going to grow up gay. Oh, he blah, blah, blah. You better be careful the way you raise him, such and such, Mrs. such and such. And he ended up in high school dating women. And now I don't really keep in touch with him except on Facebook. And I see that he dates women. So yeah. I'm assuming he's not gay. But there was just so much concern about that. And I didn't think it was wrong that we played with him. He just was another little friend. But I'm wondering if you notice a difference between the way your son plays with other little boys and how he plays with little girls, if there's a difference.
Yeah, I think there is. I think it's not so... It's very subtle, but it's definitely progressed more from when he was younger. When he was younger, I mean, I remember picking him up from the playground, and he was crying because the girls wouldn't let him play with their My Little Pony dolls.
He was
obsessed with
My Little Pony. He was a brony?
He was a total brony. And now he's like, no, I would never play with My Little Pony. But there's
definitely a conditioning happening.
Yeah. And it makes me sad. And honestly, if there was a recipe for how to raise a gay child, I would sign up for it. I would love to have a gay son. But yeah, I mean, you do, and then it's how much do you, you know, because I don't look at him as my kid. Mm. Like, this is just this being that I'm fortunate enough to kind of guide through the world.
Really?
So that's great. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard because you want them to be, I don't know, you want them to be better. Mm-hmm. And I remember that same instance when we were at the playground. I went to pick him up. I'm sitting on the park bench with him, and he's crying. And this man comes to pick up his daughter. Mm-hmm. And he looks over at us at the bench and goes, don't cry. Boys don't cry.
Oh, no!
Really? Does that still happen?
Yes, no, it does.
Really?
It really does.
That's so fun. I mean, I know I live in, like, this liberal bubble, and, like, every place I've ever lived, I, like, find my liberal bubble, and so, but that's just such a surprise to me. I'm like, haven't you read the internet? Like, don't you know how it works now? Yeah. Like, been alive for the last, like, 10 years? Like, that blows my mind. That's still a thing that happens.
Yeah, no, when I was an AmeriCorps teacher, the little boys who were picked on the most were the ones who cried and expressed their emotions mm-hmm. the most openly. Like, kids were constantly calling them all kinds of words, all kinds of mean names. Because they didn't cry any more than the little girls did. They just... Mm-hmm.
Just being human.
Yeah, they were just being human. Mm-hmm. They weren't crybabies. Okay, maybe there was one who cried more than the other kids, but for the most part, the more sensitive boys, or openly sensitive boys, cried as much as the openly sensitive girls.
And you're conditioning them to be worse partners and worse people for the women in their lives when they can't express emotion.
Absolutely.
So do you talk a lot about family at the NWL?
I know, you were asking so much about your son.
We're so curious.
We're like, how do you raise a feminist son?
So often feminist conversations are about abortion and birth control, which are important and are definitely related to being a mother and child rearing and all that. But I'm wondering how much conversation about actually raising children takes place.
Well, it's about the choice, right?
Yeah.
We talk a lot about the choice of raising a child or deciding, having the choice to decide when to do that and when is right for you. And I've had experience with abortion myself, and I'm so grateful for it. You know, I've always been pro-choice, but I'm definitely, after having a personal experience with it, you know, I'm probably even more so now. But yeah, it's really just about more like family planning, I guess.
Yeah.
And if, you know, there's such a stigma, I think, against women who don't want to have kids.
Yes.
It's always, just wait, you're too young. Mm-hmm. Or, but it'll change your life. Like, and that's why I'm so hesitant to say, like, oh, it'll change you. It doesn't change you. It just, you're just, you know, you have different responsibilities, and you have, like, a new person in your life. It's like having a new partner.
Do you think there will come a time, or I assume there will come a time, but when you explain to your son, like, yes, and, like, I had an abortion, mm-hmm. and is there any fear around that in your mind? Of, like, how am I going to tell my son this? Because there's such a stigma of, like, oh, that could have been this other person in his life, but it I love the word you used earlier, can't, because we don't usually associate that, even in pro-choice circles, with it's a woman who can't have a baby for financial or emotional or physical reasons. And I love that. Like, even, like, we're both pro-choice, so I don't think I've ever explained it that way. And, like, I want to now. I feel like that's a crucial piece that I've been missing.
No, I don't, personally, I don't fear it. Again, we live in a very liberal bubble. But, and I've always promised myself that I'd be very honest with him. So I don't. And I think the biggest challenge with abortion is removing all the stigma.
Yeah.
And you know what? It doesn't have to be this dramatic, you know, life-altering, depressing thing. It can also just be, you know what, I was so happy that I was able to do this. And yeah, there's going to be emotional backlash because you've got hormones, you've got, it's a big decision, of course. You know, you're choosing whether to have a child or not to. But I think it's unfair to put so much pressure on every woman who's going through this to be so distraught and, you know, to have all this. It's just, to me, it's very similar to having a child. There's a lot of pressure to bonding with your baby immediately, and I certainly didn't. It took me 4 to 6 months before I was like, oh, yeah, okay, I get it. This is great. So I think just women are so, and women are so hard on other women.
Because we're conditioned to be hard on other women. We're conditioned as little girls to be hard on other little girls. And it just gets worse as we get older, especially if we don't think about it or come into contact with other people who force us to think about it, challenge us to think about it.
And now, you were a doula for some amount of time, too, which is also interesting in this intersection you have with, like, birth control and abortion.
That's how you have all these great ideas, all this real life experience.
So, first of all, so where were you a doula?
In Atlanta.
In Atlanta, okay.
Yeah.
And what drove you to that?
I had a doula at my son's birth, and it was one of those things where I ended up, you know, I went into it wanting to have a natural birth, and then there were complications, and it all turned out great. I got to have them vaginally, whatever. But it was having that person there, and it was just kind of the, just her spirit and like her essence of just being in the room, someone who had experienced what I was going through, that was so helpful and made me feel so safe. So I had gone back to work after having my son, and this was during the 2008-2009 recession. And so I was back for a couple of months, and they had their third round of layoffs, so I got laid off. And I thought, okay, well, I can't not work. I don't have that in me. So I thought, what could I do, you know, because I could stay home with my son and then still have something that I could be doing, contributing somehow. And so I got certified. I talked to the doula that I had and joined their group and then got certified and did some births. And, I mean, the most rewarding time of my life, for sure.
Really? Yeah. Being a doula, why is that?
Just being in that space that's so sacred for, you know, a family where you're, I mean, you know, you're face down in their vagina, like, watching like life emerge.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's pretty special.
Very Call the Midwife. I don't know if you've seen that show, but it's like many hankies.
I've heard, and that's why I haven't watched it yet.
It's so good. It's like they always have this, like, voiceover where it's like, and the beauty of life made new again. You're like, oh, my gosh, babies are so great.
They are, and then they're also not. Like, if you're,
they're
not
also ready, the worst,
right? They're also, yeah. And that was so great at the consciousness raising. It was really funny because my son's, you know, running around, and there's a woman saying, "I never want kids. They are like a nightmare." I'm like, "This is awesome. Like,
this is great. You're not wrong."
Yeah,
but I love my son also.
But to know that, like, it is hard work. It is, you know, and you don't have to do it. Nobody is going to make, I mean, unfortunately, people are trying to make you have a baby, which I don't understand.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't have to do it if you don't want to.
Yeah, and if you're not going to do it right, please don't do it. Please, don't. Yeah.
I was reading an article the other day about, I think it was, like, Iowa or some, like, Midwestern state was trying to make a rule about child abandonment, and the idea was that if you abandon your child within, like, the first 6 months you will not be criminalized. And it was in this, it was this attempt to stem some sort of problem to, like, okay, if you're going to be a shitty, awful parent and your kid is going to end up in foster care, please do it within the first 6 months so that we can, like, because then those kids are most likely to get adopted.
Yeah.
But what ended up happening is they didn't actually stipulate, like, a six-month block, and so people drove, like, 13 hours from other states to, like, abandon their 13-year-olds. Because there were these people that didn't want kids. Yeah. But they grew up or moved to or lived in areas that they didn't have, like, the knowledge of family planning. And, like, that's the why it's so super important to have access to all of this information. Yes. Is because they just assumed, like, oh, I'm pregnant now, I have to have this baby, or yeah. I'm married now, I have to have kids. Mm-hmm. And then had lived with that decision for 10 years, and once it was made an option that they wouldn't go to jail, just, like, abandoned their children.
Yeah.
And if we had, and it's stunning to me to think about if we erased the stigma, if we gave women these options, you wouldn't have these parents abandoning their kids in Iowa.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And then
that's so much worse.
Yes.
You would think. Yeah, you would think. And a lot of these, discussions is we're really trying to get to the root. Like, why do they want us to have kids? Mm-hmm. What's their motive? And, you know, conspiracy theories aside, is it just to keep us at home with kids, buying shit, being consumers, and... I don't know, you just have to wonder at some point, what's in it for you?
Right.
For me to have.
I do wonder how, like, male legislators who are so anti-women and make all of these decisions, I often wonder, like, how much of that is just ingrained in them and they mm-hmm. don't challenge it, and how much of it is a planned attack, if that makes sense.
I'm sure a lot of it has to do with, you know, political strategy and getting voters. And
that's what I wonder. Like, is it, are you, I'm trying to figure out, like, are you stupid or are you evil? And sometimes I really don't know.
There's a fine line, I think.
No, I absolutely agree, but it's, and then there was that senator recently who said that women shouldn't be paid equally because that takes away from men and women should go home and, like, raise their children. And there's stuff like that that I think more men in particular and people in general think, but that is so, has been, like, under the surface for the last 8 years, and people have been uncomfortable talking about it, and now we've made this political space where at long last people feel comfortable
being racist and sexist terrible.
It's like that Aziz Ansari SNL bit where he talks about it. I was like, how do I communicate to racists it's not okay to be racist? Like, we, like, made this space. We're like, yes, I can finally be racist again. You're like, no, I'm still, like, that's still a barrier. Like, we're not all chill with that anymore. But I feel like that's the same space that's been made for women's issues.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, good, we can finally talk about how I want all my women to, like, stay home and, like, make less than men and, like, raise their children, and I just want to legislate my idea of what morality is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, it's imposing your beliefs on the mass majority, which doesn't work.
Yeah. No. I wanted to backpedal and talk about geography a little bit, because Mari was talking about the Midwest and this legislation. You live in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Mari and I are from the suburbs of D.C. originally, Virginia side. We lived in Richmond, Virginia. So we have this north and south background. But I'm curious about what it was like discussing women's rights in Atlanta, which is big. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, the middle of nowhere, but it's still the South.
It is. Yeah, Atlanta's funny because it's almost this microcosm. And as soon as you leave, you drive like a half an hour outside of it, you're like, oh, right, we're in Georgia.
Okay, so it's like Richmond, so where we went to college.
Yeah, you are kind of in, you know, a little bit of a bubble there with a lot of like-minded people. And I think what's great about Atlanta is watching it, you know, they've been having their own marches and really being active lately, which is so cool to see, because you think of the South, you don't think of progressive. You know, but it's been pretty great to see that. But as far as, you know, discussions, I'm fortunate enough to have a really amazing group of female friends that I've known for almost 15 years now. Most of them live in Atlanta, but are kind of split between Atlanta, LA, New York, majority in Atlanta, though. And I feel so fortunate knowing them because they have kind of helped to enforce my views, because there's so much support, and they've never been the type of friends to, you know, compete or see me as a threat, and I think that's so crucial. And I had an experience in New York with a new friend, you know, when I first moved here. I thought, okay, this is great. And then had an experience where there was that feeling of, oh, you're new at this female friendship thing. I'm not a threat to you.
Oh, God.
I'm not here to, I'm not competing with you. But it was a wake-up call. It's like, oh, so not every woman is like the women that I've surrounded myself with. So I felt lucky in that, where everyone that I was friends with or communicated with at work was all kind of on the same page in varying degrees. There are people I know in New York who are like, sexism, I don't know. I think you're just kind of being a little,
just so touchy.
I mean, like, laughing, but like, to keep
you nasty
crying.
Woman.
Yeah, exactly. Like, let it go, you know. No,
we don't live in Saudi Arabia.
No,
we don't. But that's not
the point.
That's not the point. The point is, like, I don't just want like most of the rights. I want all of them.
All of them. So when I know that doulas are very popular with religious women and non-religious women. That is one of those things that some people might think, oh, well, that's only a feminist thing, blah, blah, blah. It's only very progressive.
Like, only, like, hippie women hippies, who, like, want their doulas.
Yeah, but there are many more conservative or traditional women who are interested. So did you have a mix of different kinds of clients in Atlanta?
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing is, the discussions with clients...
Are they called patients? Or are they called something
else? We call them clients.
Clients, yeah. Okay. Wasn't sure.
Yeah, it never really got into that sort of thing. So it was already like, oh, yeah, you're obviously having a baby. Like, what are you talking about abortion right now?
You made your choice.
Yeah. But there's a range, for sure. And I think it's more well known now. It's about it's not this kind of witchcraft thing. And it's all right. Just having support. Just having somebody who's been through it, who, you know, knows how to help comfort you. And... yeah.
Do you still keep in contact with any of the women that you've been a doula for? Like, I have no idea what doulas do. Do you, like, call them, like, 6 months later and be like, what's up? How's your baby?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be a doula for two of my very good friends.
Aww.
So I do keep in touch with them. And I get to see, one is, like, one of my best friends. So we stay in touch quite a bit. And I get to see the kids growing up. And so that's pretty amazing. And the other has gone on to have, she's in her fourth child now. So,
wow.
Yeah. Four kids is when you get to, like, my cousin, my beloved cousin has four kids. And I've actually talked about her before on the radio show. But it's just, like, that's a lot of kids. Like, there's no, I have nothing more to say about that. Yeah. But it's just, like, they're all amazing and wonderful. But, like, once you get to four kids, it's, like, you're kind of drowning.
Yeah, you're the minority. For
you're
sure.
the minority in your house, and you're responsible for a lot of people's, like, lives and bath schedules.
Yes.
And that's but that's also amazing.
Yeah, it looks, I mean, the pictures look like so much fun, for sure. But then, yeah. But I mean, pictures I can scroll through.
Right.
Like, I don't think I could do personally, but I love that they're doing it.
Yeah, you're like, oh, this looks really fun. Like, I like the distance that I have between you guys, and, like, I'm enjoying the observation. No, that's definitely how I feel about it, too.
But the beauty of that, right, that you one woman can decide to have four kids, one can decide to have none. That's really what it's all about. It's crazy.
Okay, let's say, could you just walk us through the process? Your client's water breaks, then what? What's the next step?
It depends. It's not like the movies.
Okay.
You don't have your baby right after the water.
We don't have babies. Clearly, we do not have children. We're just like, movies, books.
I will tell you, too, a lot of women, their water doesn't break. The majority of, like, 90-something percent of women, their water doesn't break.
So what happens? How do they know there's a baby coming?
Contractions.
Okay.
Painful.
And
they
hurts.
They like to use the word waves. Like,
waves.
Painful.
Yeah, waves sounds way too nice.
All the euphemisms.
Generous, yeah. Yeah, and it depends on the woman. That's the great thing. It's every woman has her own birth plan.
Yeah.
Some women want to wait until, you know, they're ready to give birth to go to the hospital. Some of them want to do it at home. Some of them want to be in the hospital as soon as possible so they can kind of settle in.
Right.
Yeah, but it really depends. And what's so great about it is that, and what keeps it so kind of engaging and exciting is that every single birth is just like every single individual. And it's so different. The timeline, some are super fast. Some can last 40 hours.
That sounds awful.
So, but the doula doesn't, get involved until, I mean, apart from some kind of consultation or planning, before the woman goes into labor, the doula doesn't show up again until the mother is at the hospital or the mother's in her living room with the baby pool or whatever's going on.
Again, it depends. It depends how much interaction they want. So sometimes we'll meet them at the hospital. Sometimes we'll meet them at their home and ride, follow them to the hospital. Depends. Yeah. It's all so different.
Yeah.
Which is good.
I'm like making my baby plan right now.
Well, it's interesting to me is like how often like birth plans go as planned. Like I know my mom told me my birth plan for when I was born once and like,
tell us what it was.
It was just so clearly a first child birth plan. Like, it was, she made a mixtape of the, you know the movie Out of Africa with Meryl Streep?
Yes!
It had the, it was that soundtrack. And she's like, I wanted to play it as you were being born. Like, daddy was going to be my birth coach. And then I was like, I was a C-section baby. So I was just like, like, nothing went according to plan. But I also think that birth plans are important. Because I know my mom, and I know if she hadn't had a birth plan, like, it would have been so much more traumatic. And I actually think that I think if she could have had a doula, that would have been really good for her. Like, my mom is just, she radiates kindness and for that reason, she's also very anxious, and she wants everyone to be okay all the time, and like forgets about herself.
Do we have the same mother?
and then you get like these like activist like sort of girls out of that who are like, I just want you to be okay. Like I feel like my mom is so anxious in part because of like constraints on her as a woman and trying to be a people pleaser.
Yeah,
I definitely feel like I've like responded to that and being like, well, fuck everyone, like come at me, but. Yeah, I think that I think her birth plan was important, and I think that if she had had, I think that doulas are maybe sometimes seen as being, like, a luxury in some ways. Right. Like, oh, you're not just, like, this crazy hippie, but you're like, spending extra money to have,
you're
like,
a rich crazy hippie.
Yeah, you're a rich crazy.
Which is worse.
Yeah, yeah. But like, as you're saying, you have this real diversity of clients, and I think that if we could sort of erase some of that stigma, like, I feel like my mom would have really benefited from having someone just be like, listen, it's fine. It's totally fine. You're doing great. Like, just having someone around who knows what's coming.
And someone just to say, this is normal. Everything you're going through is normal. Which, I mean, I'd love that in life, for someone to just tap me on the shoulder and be like, it's so normal.
Yeah. I wrote an article recently about, like, witchcraft. And, like, one of the things I like about witchcraft and tarot is that you just have someone who's, like, a psychic or a medium or someone just being like, you're fine. Like, you're, the spirits say you're good. I'm like, I don't care if that is false or true. I thank you. That is what I've wanted from therapy for years.
Exactly.
No one has ever said that.
Exactly.
So it's very clear how your background as a doula informs your activism, your community building, but how does it inform your design at all? Is there a connection there?
Well, the feminism in the workplace is something I'd be happy to touch on.
Do it.
So I work in a field where pretty much every meeting I'm at, I'm the only woman.
Ooh.
At a table of old white men, right? And it's interesting because I've noticed in the past year that I've become a lot more vocal about things that I'm, like, you know, whether it's actually more than in a year, but just everything from, you know, my reviews to asking for increases that I know that I'm worth. And I think that's such an important thing for women to learn how to do because it's so difficult. But also for me, the biggest thing is, I mean, I deal with sexism on like an hourly basis at work. But for me, what I've learned is I need to start calling people out on it. I can't expect them to grow and change if they don't know what they're doing is wrong. So I've been more aware of that and really trying to call people out, not in an aggressive or, you know, rude way, but just acknowledging it.
Yeah. How do you go about that? Because I also, like, there's a lot of sexism in my workplace as well. I'm in, like, an ultra-Orthodox religious community at work. And so the sexism is different. And it's, like, one of those things where I'm like, oh, well, part of this is cultural. And so I have to be, like, respectful. But how do you do it? Like, if someone says something, says or does something sexist, like, do you pull them aside? How do you do it?
No, I was having a meeting with a team meeting. And one of the design directors said we were looking at a plan, you know, of a building, and we're trying to incorporate an additional building. And the structure of the building kind of jutted out into corners, right? And we're sitting at the table, and he said, you know, what are we going to do about these nipples here?
Ew.
And I was like, all right. And then he said it one more time, and I said, can you not call those nipples? Because I was not the, and it's like, yeah, and of course this can be read as like, you're being so sensitive, like, let it go. But I was not the only female there. There was another one, and I watched her, and she got uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And this is also someone who's, like, notorious for being, like,
gross.
Yeah, sexual assault issues. But, I'm to the point where I don't care. Like, you need to know that that's inappropriate. And especially in that environment, and I'm so tired of seeing these jokes be made and the other guys at the table just kind of laugh it off. And we're stuck feeling, I don't know, like we have to just shut up and deal with it. I'm tired of dealing with it.
Do you think that your ability to sort of call these guys out comes from, in part, like, you're just at a point in your career where you're valuable enough that, like, they're not going to fire you? Like, I worry about that sometimes.
Yeah,
I'm like, I know I'm really good at my job, and I know that if every time I, like, threaten to leave, my manager's like, stop, give me 2 minutes, I will go negotiate. Right. But at a certain point, I don't know if I'm valuable enough that I can, like, call out managers on being sexist, which some of them are.
Here's the problem. You are valuable enough. Like, the thought of putting, that drives me crazy, is the thought of putting my value. We kind of equate our personal value with our job value,
definitely,
which is so wrong.
Yeah.
But it's to the point where, do I want to work in a place
that
won't allow me to do that? If I'm going to have to deal with these scenarios and I'm not able to speak out about how I feel or how it's offending me, then do I even want to work in a place like that? So I think part of it is, experience, you know, age, level, and career, there is a comfort level. But to me, it's also about setting an example for the younger designers.
Yeah.
And I've seen them have to interact with things where I've had to stand up and be like, nope.
That's not okay.
You cannot speak to her that way, you know. And that's, and I think as women, because there's so much women-on-women hate, which... is such a problem. It's really about, in your daily activities and in your work environment, about lifting women up, right?
Yeah.
When you see a coworker, just like, let's praise each other, you know? And I see so many older women, and I mean, not really older, I guess, but women my age even, who get threatened by younger designers. And we are all in this together. Like, we want to lift each other up. So I think trying to be more aware of that too. So to the converse of, you know, the male female dynamic, it's the female female dynamic,
right?
And trying to instill that not dignity, but that confidence.
Well, I'm sure because those younger women experience sexism in a way that's slightly different than the way you experience it. Like, I know for me, I'm just now beginning to age out of that category of being what is interpreted as, like, stupid cute girl, stupid cute young girl, and that's kind of a weird, interesting place, because the sexism that I encounter is different now.
Yeah,
like, it's still, there's still some overlap, there's still, like, gross old men, like, thinking that they can take advantage of me, But that's happening less and less,
yeah.
I think, because I'm just slightly older, mm-hmm. and, like, I'm sort of in my, I'm transitioning into mid to late 20s now, and there's this interpretation, oh, I can't, like, so overtly take advantage
yeah.
of this girl. And then eventually you get into this weird place where you just, like, get ignored, because, like, you're no longer an overt sexual object. But it's weird to see that, to feel that transition happening, because I know there's going to come a time where, like, I'm going to have to, like, defend the girl. I'm going to have to defend girls who are in the position that I was in, like, 3 years ago. And I don't know, is that, like, a cycle that is just forever? Like, I think about sometimes when we have these feminist conversations, I'm like, is this just forever? Like, are we...
How much of this is biological? How much of this
right,
is about evolution?
Exactly.
She is of the... in the prime of her life,
that's what
can
I mean.
Have so many babies right now.
It's like I'm already thinking right now, like, okay, so, like, I'm no longer that, like, 22-year-old that is just, like, a peach that is just, like, the
so
object.
So fertile.
So fertile. Just, like, this, the object of leery men, but, like, now I'm already planning in my head, like, what am I going to do to defend those women? And at one point I'm like, yeah, I'm glad that I, like, know what's coming. On another end, I'm like, is this just forever? Like, do we just have to play this game until we die?
It is. It's very overwhelming. And you do. I have these moments all the time. I'm like, between what's the point and fight, fight, fight.
Yeah.
But I guess if you think of it more on a personal level and who you're kind of interacting with on a daily basis and who you're affecting on a daily basis, that's the only thing that I've been able to grasp onto.
Right.
And fighting for those big picture things at the same time in
yeah.
hopes that there can be some real change. Yeah, because I mean, with the committee, what we're trying to do is get free abortion.
Really?
Which is crazy, right?
Yeah.
Sounds crazy.
I would say that, is that a pipe dream or is that...
Well, you know, they were, so the whole CR thing actually assisted in getting the morning after pill available over the counter.
Right, I remember that.
Yeah, so they got, I think it was one brand
mm-hmm.
that was available. And then the others, there's some generic ones that you still have to show your ID
right.
under 17.
Mm-hmm.
So those kinds of things give me hope.
That's true.
And
right, because those were interpreted as like abortion pills like
right.
3 years ago.
Which is insane.
It's nuts.
The morning
yeah.
after. There's no baby in there.
Right.
Life begins at conception.
yeah.
We talked about that last episode. When does life begin?
Oh my God. When I decide.
When
yeah.
I decide.
I feel like it. Yeah, so it, I mean, it's ambitious, but why not, you know?
And I shoot for the stars.
Why
yeah.
not? And we deserve it. And it's, you know, we talk a lot about repeal versus reform in these meetings.
Hmm.
And what a false sense of any sense of that you have control over something. So if they say, oh, we're going to reform this law, so now, let's say at now instead of 8 weeks, now you can wait until you're 10 weeks pregnant to have an abortion. And it goes, oh, great. Oh, that gives me so much more freedom. No, it doesn't. It's, you know,
yeah.
There's a good analogy in one of the writings, I forget which article it was, where they use the idea of an iron chain around your neck versus an aluminum one. So you're still bound.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's this false idea of, oh, now I have more rights. But why should they have any control over what you're doing with your body, whether it's birth control or abortion? Why should they have any input over what's going on? So it's really, I think that's the point of it all, is not to reform these things, but just completely throw them out the window and not have any involvement in our lives.
Yeah. So I want to transition a little bit
mm-hmm.
into the Tom Price Speak Out.
Yes.
Can you tell me what that's about?
Yes. March 16th, we are organizing a Speak Out in front of HHS.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is, I mean, he's kind of a detriment to ACA, to our healthcare as a whole,
mm-hmm.
Wants to basically overthrow the affordable healthcare. And he, I mean, as a person, he is so in conflict with what he's representing, which I think
right.
all members are right now.
Yeah, I mean, he has all these big pharma conflicts.
Exactly. And he's getting, I think it was hundreds of thousands of dollars that he got paid.
Nuts.
So there's a lot of self-interest there.
Yeah.
So he's one of those where I don't think he really gives a shit whether I'm having a baby or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's hitting his pocket and he's getting rich off of it.
Hmm.
Off of these legal things. So the Speak Out is really to represent NWL. We'll have women speaking from personal experience with abortion, with birth control. We'll show all of the reformations that have happened. And it's just to kind of bring an awareness to the dangers that could be with this guy in office. And I mean, a guy who doesn't think that women have trouble accessing birth control.
That was my next question, is he said that. And, like, that to me, like, do you think that that's stupidity or do you think that that's willful deceit?
I think that's rich white man.
Yeah.
He was so naive to think that there are women who don't have, because I'm sure everyone he knows probably doesn't have any issue.
Right.
I personally don't have an issue. I have health insurance. I'm fine.
Right.
You know, but of course there's race, class, there's all these things, but it's even like freelancers. It's,
yeah.
You know, it's college students. It affects so many women on so many levels. It's insurance policies, you know, it's being able to afford one brand of birth control and not another,
mm-hmm.
but that one may cause you to lose your mind.
Right.
No, exactly. It's like you can only take estrogen birth control pills. Yeah. Like, do you want to have to live in your brain while you're not exactly. getting pregnant?
Do you want to be on, psychosomatic drugs that time, too?
Yeah.
And then there's this whole issue with cancer. You think about estrogen-based cancers.
Yeah.
And women who are finding out they have breast cancer, and could it have possibly been because they were pumping their bodies full of these birth control pills? I don't know. Maybe. There's just...
Need some more research.
Yeah, do some more research. There, and for me, it's like, there's got to be a better way. There has to be a better way. And then when you read about they're doing studies on male birth control, and then they withdraw the funding and the study because they experience some mood swings.
It's just so hard. Men can't do it.
And depression, and like, give me a break.
Yeah.
But it was such a slap in the face. It proves that their lives are more valuable.
Yep. No, yep. That's exactly what it is.
Yep.
Because women are expected to suffer through all of those things. And we will, is and the thing, will. Too. And, like, we will because we don't have another option.
Right.
Like, you either suffer through the depression of being on this birth control that makes you nuts, or you have a baby, or you have to have $400 so you can have an abortion.
Exactly.
Like, it's not... Like, men have all these options, and they don't even realize how many wonderful options they have.
Or the best option, they can walk away.
Yeah.
You know?
The best option of all.
But seriously, they can, I mean, they have the freedom to, if you have to have a baby, they can walk away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is not ideal, but there's a lot more options for them, for sure.
Well, Krista, we have to wrap up. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you like what you hear, consider donating by visiting our page at the Radio Free Brooklyn website and clicking on the little green button at the bottom of the page. I'm Mari Pack.
I'm Christine Stoddard.
Be sure to tune in next week for more interviews with the women changing Brooklyn.